Ahoy, mateys, and welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. Today, I'm your host, First Mate Slykick, and with me, as always, is Captain Spike.
Ahoy!
Today is November 29th, 2015, and this is Episode 98. Episode 98, The Wilderness Downtown, a GameBuoy spotlight on Animal Crossing. Welcome again, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
Oh gosh, is that what I sound like? Anyway, this week we're continuing our Ninty 90s and taking a look at the nearly 15-year history of Nintendo's best-selling and beloved Life Sim series.
Tamodachi Life!
No, not Tamodachi Life. Animal Crossing. So, buckle in and get ready for that. But first, our usual slate of follow-ups and news bits. Captain Spike, would you like to get us started?
Yes, the first piece of news here we have is one I'm super, super excited about. We recently got word that Guilty Gear Xrd Revelator will be coming to North America on the PlayStation 3 and PlayStation 4 this spring. That is to say, the spring of 2016. So, please look forward to it.
Indeed, that's very exciting. We also have word that Compile Heart has put out a new trailer for Hyperdimension Great War Neptune versus Sega Hard Girls. And so that's showing off the gameplay, the battle system, and the characters of the crossover of the Neptunia series with the beloved Sega Hard Girls.
And, you know, this game actually came out in Japan last week, so I'm really looking forward to hearing, sort of import reviewers' takes on it. And, if there's no announcement of this coming stateside, I will definitely be importing it and letting everyone out there know how it is.
Oh, definitely. You know, the Neptunia series has surprisingly had a pretty good reception over here, so we'll keep our fingers crossed.
We also finally got the official announcement of some titles that we had heard previously rumors of. That is, of course, Valkyria Azure Revolution. This is going to be a PlayStation 4 title. It is a sequel/side story to the original game. It will apparently take a more real-time bend on the strategic gameplay the series is known for. Additionally, for PlayStation 4, a Valkyria Chronicles remaster has been announced. The remaster will be available in Japan on February 10th, 2016. Valkyria Azure Revolution will release in Japan at winter 2016, and both have been acknowledged for eventual worldwide release, so please look forward to it.
That's fantastic. And news that's exciting for you, Captain Spike, we have word that Frankie Shogun and X-Drake are going to be the newest character additions to One Piece Burning Blood.
So, oh, exciting.
Yeah, that's pretty cool news. And also exciting is that Nine from the BlazBlue universe will finally be a playable character in BlazBlue Central Fiction.
Excellent. Final Fantasy Explorers, of course, is coming stateside, as recently confirmed by Nintendo and Square Enix. We have word here that all 21 jobs that were eventually made available for the Japanese release, that is to say the 19 available with the base game as well as the 2 DLC jobs, will be available on the game cartridge on launch day in North America.
Oh, that's exciting.
So please keep looking forward to that. It releases January 26th.
In a follow-up to our news of Dragon Quest Heroes, The World Trees Woe and The Blight Below coming to PC, we now know that that will be a slime edition, which has 11 slime-themed weapons.
Oh, excellent. Very similar to the first print release copies on PS4 this past summer that came out, I guess.
Yeah.
That was summer.
So that's a very good piece of news.
You included this news just for that pun.
No, also we love Dragon Quest. We also love...
This will be available on December 3rd, so not too long after you hear this episode.
Oh, yeah. We also love Midboss Games, the folks behind the GamerX convention.
We love you guys.
And they recently announced that they will be bringing their debut cyberpunk retro adventure game, Read Only Memories, to PS4 and Vita. No release window yet, but please look forward to that. You know, if you haven't checked it out on Steam, you want to wait until you can play it on a Sony title, on a Sony console, then you might want to check it out.
We've previously talked about the 3 games coming up to Steam from one of my personal favorite Japanese niche game series, that is, of course, the Umihara Kawase series. Now, there will be a bundle of the 3 titles. This is the Umihara Kawase Trilogy Collection. It will have Umihara Kawase, Umihara Kawase Shun, and Sayonara Umihara Kawase Plus, and that's going to be a $29.99 package, which is, basically giving you Umihara Kawase for free.
$6.98 saving. I did the math.
Oh, fantastic.
Yep, and that's available now, so
available now.
Check it out. And before we move on to our release date info, we have word that Andy Bogard is the newest member of the King of Fighters 14 roster. And in addition to that, SNK Playmore has announced that the first playable demo of the game is going to be at next weekend's PlayStation Experience in San Francisco.
Oh, fantastic. You know, we won't be there ourselves, even though it is happening super close by. There's just too much going on in the next couple of weeks for us. But I'm sure that we will hear a lot about how these characters play, how this game plays, and I bet we'll have a lot more video footage after next weekend. So please look forward to it. We will definitely be sharing our thoughts on that.
Indeed. In release date news, we have word that the Asia version of Mobile Suit Gundam Extreme Versus Force, the one with the English subtitles, will be releasing in February 2016, those of you who are looking to import. We also have news from Square Enix that Deus Ex Mankind Divided has been delayed from February 23rd to August 23rd. This is due to, in their words, the need for post-production adjustments. They want to release a game that improves upon Human Revolution, so they need the extra time to do that.
I'm glad to hear that, but it also raises some red flags for me that, like, I guess they felt the game need... They're acknowledging the game needs to go back to the drawing board for 6 months. Like, I'm super stoked to hear this news, you know? Like I said, I've said previously, it's always, to me, it's a little bit of a celebration, practically, when a game gets delayed to improve it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that's a big delay. So I hope they nail it. I hope the game turns out great. I liked Human Revolution a lot, but I was not super pleased to hear this.
Yeah, it's a bummer. Something that might make you feel better is that Earth Defense Force 4.1 and Earth Defense Force 2 are hitting North America on December 8th.
Oh, exciting. Hopefully someone will buy it for me for my birthday.
Right? Our European listeners might be happy to know that Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth is hitting on February 5th in the European region. And news that everyone can be excited about, hopefully, is that Gravity Rush Remastered will be releasing a week earlier than originally planned. So now we can get that on February 2nd.
And something else that's really exciting is that, you know, Sony heard the fan demand and will be releasing a physical copy of Gravity Rush Remastered. It will no longer be a digital only. You will, in North America, be able to go to your favorite brick-and-mortar store and buy a physical copy.
Those still exist?
You say that, but we were at Best Buy like 2 days ago.
Yeah.
We were at GameStop yesterday. So yeah, they exist.
That's true.
Shady bitch.
They're kind of evil. Anyways, I think it's time for
News. Oh my god, news.
Our first news story today is confirmation that Disgaea, the long-lived series which many of us completely lose our shit over, is coming to the PC this upcoming February. This was confirmed via Nipponichi Software America. The game already has a page up on Steam. It is apparently going to be a new port of the original Disgaea release, with some kind of new functionalities, though we don't know to what degree that will be yet.
That's awesome. In some very niche news, we have the word that VG Person, who you might be familiar with if you follow the freeware Japanese horror games scene, she is a translator of these such games. She has released her own called Libretta, which involves a girl lost in a library. So that's always cool to see, you know, more people getting involved in the indie development scene. So you can go check that out. It's also for free, much like the games that she translates.
Is it wrong that I was totally saying that to myself, like Bayonetta, like Libretta?
No, that's valid.
We also have word that for reasons completely beyond my understanding, Bubsy the Bobcat might be making a comeback. This is brought to us via Steam Greenlight. We're going to link you to polygon.com over at gamebuoy.org.
Gamebuoy.org.
The game in question is called The Bubsy Twofer. Apparently this is a press release put out by Retroism, who actually, you know, Retroism is well-liked and is a potential re-release of Bubsy the Bobcat's first two 2D platformers, Bubsy, Claws Encounters of the Furred Kind, and Bubsy 2. So these games are on Greenlight right now. Retroism is using a hashtag Save Bubsy to try and get, you know, the green light green lit, and if that happens, we will definitely tell you more about it.
Yeah, like
I don't even know how to feel about this, but you know, they're saying that the games will be available for $4.99 each, and like for $5 I might revisit Bubsy.
Maybe.
I'm part of the problem.
Nexon has released details about their newest smartphone strategy game. It's called MOE, Masters of Eternity.
Bitch, we see what you did there.
Well, predictably, it does involve cute anime girls, but they're also mech pilots. So basically, you have to, like, uncover their secrets while they, you know, pilot mechs.
Naughty secrets?
Possibly.
Probably. It's literally a game called MOE.
And in news that should have everybody excited, the Kickstarter that Hatful Boyfriend is running for their plush toy series has passed the $95,000 mark, which means it's hit all of its stretch goals. So if you want a plush of Ryota, Okusan, Shu, Nageki, Angel, Sakuya, Yuya, or Kazuaki, you can get them if you pledge on their Kickstarter before December 6th. The toys themselves should be out by May 2016.
Fantastic. You know, I'm looking at these little sketches of the plushies, and they're just super cute. I hope these get made, and I want all of them.
Right.
We also have word here of a new release in the Puzzle & Dragons series. This is for the 3DS. It is called Puzzle & Dragons Cross, and it's going to be, you know, very similar to Puzzle & Dragons Z, which we somewhat recently got released in North America. So think of it as like an expansion of that game.
Indeed.
Puzzle & Dragons Cross will release in Japan in 2016 for the Nintendo 3DS.
Shanghai-based studio Pixpil Games is going to be releasing an action-adventure game called Eastward, and this seems cool because it's kind of meant to emulate some of the, you know, earlier 2D Zelda games like A Link to the Past, but something else that's really cool is that their pixel art aesthetic is meant to kind of bring back the look of, like, 90s anime. They have, like, you know, with the shading they're using and such. So, you know, those two things kind of hit all of our marks here at Game Buoy. So.
Well, and something that's really cool is that while it is a pixel-based game in terms of its art design, it actually uses, like, a 3D modeling, light sourcing style, which actually creates a really striking image that Slaggy was talking about with the, you know, the anime shading and stuff. So potentially this could be a really exciting one. Definitely one to keep your eyes on.
Indeed.
We also have word here that PlayStation 2 emulation will be coming to the PS4 in some context. You may recall we've talked about this previously on the show when the bundle of Star Wars games was announced as coming to PlayStation 4. That was to say Star Wars Racer Revenge, Star Wars Jedi Starfighter, and Star Wars Bounty Hunter.
And Super Star Wars.
Okay, so Super Star Wars, while a part of that bundle, is not a PS2 game being emulated.
SNES.
The other games are PS2 games. They're being emulated using a apparently very, very functional emulator that is working, you know, in real time on the PS4, emulating these games better than they actually appeared on PS4, you know, with some of the
on PS2.
I'm sorry, better than they appeared on PS2, you know, with some of the you know, tweaks and perks that we saw in PlayStation Classics versions on PlayStation 3. So this is definitely something to be excited about. Sony has not yet really officially commented too much on this, but the fact that they dropped these games on, you know, sort of on the down low practically, to me tells me that there's an announcement coming. So that's speculation, but something to keep an eye open
maybe
on.
Maybe at a big Sony event that's coming up?
Who knows? Who knows?
If you're looking for an LOL, then you should download the riff tracks of the 1999 film The Wizard, which is, of course, the game, the story about a boy who goes to play in a Nintendo championship. And for those who aren't familiar, riff tracks is the series that's kind of spawned off of the Mystery Science Theater 3000 television show, which is also having a comeback, which is exciting. And, you know, they make fun of it, so sounds like a good time.
Excellent. You know, there's a news story here that you passed over, and I think it might be because it's not relevant anymore, but I still want to talk about it because I have a talking point here. Valve is changing the way Steam sales work. And, you know, the Steam sale will be over by the time you hear this episode out there in Internet Radio Land, but this is still something I wanted to talk about.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Rather than games having individual daily deals or flash sales prices, everything just got their lowest price throughout the complete duration of the sale event. And something that was, you know, it's considered a change for us in a positive way. It's really meant to be sort of less exploitative of impulse purchases, you know, sort of less exploited by, you know, people who are just looking for some cards and then maybe want to claim a refund or whatever an hour later. So, you know, it's overall a positive change, but, and I'm wondering if this is true for you, Slaggy, did it make the Steam sale less exciting this year?
Well, I mean, I was too busy to really look into it, but...
I guess what I mean is, you know, we were at Seawolf Jason's house yesterday, and we did all pull out our phones, take a look at the Steam app, and talk about sales for a minute or two. But all I can think back is to previous years where every couple of hours when sale prices
were changing
over, we're all pestering each other. What did you vote for? What did you vote for? Oh, hey, I really want this game. Can you vote for it for me? We're all talking about what games are on sale, what games we're going to buy, what games are we hoping go on sale. It felt a little bit more like a special event. It felt more interactive. It definitely had us, you know, talking and acting more as a community. So to me, it's like, I get why on a pragmatic level this change makes sense, why it's a good thing, but it, to me, it took a lot of the fun out of it.
I could see that.
Anyway, just food for thought, I guess.
Yeah. So we once again have word from Shigesato Itoi-san that there will be no Mother 4. He is quoted as saying, among big-time pop stars, if they, you know, put out 10 albums, around the fourth album, they can't make very good songs. The albums sell, but everyone at the concert wants to hear the songs from those first three albums. Everyone. I'm glad that video games are not my profession. If it was my job, I would have already made 4 and 5.
Yeah, and you know, this basically just goes along with what he's said previously, indicating that, you know, if he ever really has a strong drive to make a 4, he'll make a 4, but he doesn't really see it as being a thing that's going to happen.
Yep.
And that's, it is what it is. I don't think it's a bad thing, and, you know, cool, although I'm sure people are going to keep asking for it, and he's going to keep having to make statements like this.
Yeah.
We also have word here that G-Rev, who of course is a fairly popular Japanese indie studio, probably most well known for 2D shmups, is going to be releasing on Steam in North America even. Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, it's already available.
This game is already available. Strania, the Stella Machina. I think this is fantastic. I'm actually have been looking into this all weekend. I didn't realize it was on sale now. I may have to just stop recording and play it now.
Excuse me. You can do it during my next news bit.
Fair enough. Why don't you have it?
In other news, Nintendo of Japan has announced that they will be selling standalone gamepads finally for the Wii U. They're going to be going for the price of 12,800 yen, which is approximately $104 US. So, you know, definitely pricey, but if you need to replace it and you're in Japan, you'll be able to. No word yet on any sort of domestic release for that.
And something very important to note here is that Wii U gamepads are region locked.
Yes.
So if you're in the market for a new gamepad, maybe yours broken, you haven't had it repaired yet, do not order one from Japan.
Yeah. And there will still only be one per system, you know, like, so you can't just have, like, magically three gamepads or something.
Well, yeah, no, Nintendo was very clear from the get-go that there was not even initially the intention to have multiple gamepads per console. It is apparently now done in such a way that if they ever have a title that needs it, they can implement it.
Oh.
But it's not a thing that exists presently. There are no games that require two. The system software as it currently stands does not support it. And honestly, given the way that the Wii U ship is gone, I wouldn't hold your breath that'll ever be a thing.
Well, maybe the Wii U ship has not gone far, but
girl from the
Keita Takahashi and Bandai Namco collaboration Nobi Nobi Boy has gone far. In fact, she has reached Pluto.
Oh, wow.
It took a total of 2,468 days for a girl to reach Pluto, which means you can now select Pluto as a playable area. And I'm not really sure why, but her next stop is the sun. So I guess she's like circling all the way back around now.
I think that was the end point. Like, that's it, right? Nobi girl goes to the sun and then it's over, right?
I believe so, but I just don't know why she didn't catch that earlier. You know, she's going to have to go all the way back around now.
Well, you know, if you heard this news and it brought, you know, delight to your face, gave you a smile because you fondly remember Nobi Nobi Boy, maybe load it up for a little while, help girl out, and, you know, let's see if we can get back to the sun.
And in fitting news for today, there's going to be a DLC client for Happy Home Designer Animal Crossing. And, you know, this is going to be a little different than the usual Amiibo card clients. The Japanese version of the game is getting a client for download who wants a game store themed home. So that means that there will be little Amiibo figures in the game as, like, furniture. And you can also have a Game Boy, 3DS, Wii U, a new 3DS, and a new 3DS XL, and then a rack of virtual Amiibo. So that's very cute. Hopefully we get it over here.
Okay, but can we just talk about how in, like, the GameStop-alike type store that is in this screenshot, on the far left hand, there's, like, a 2D fighting game of Mario and Luigi fighting?
That's adorable.
Because that is adorable. Like, Nintendo, you know what we want. You're gonna tease us, but, you know, make some more fighting games. Thanks.
Yeah, right.
And last but never, ever, ever least, we have word here that Sony will be officially releasing remote play capabilities for PS4 on the PC and Mac platforms. You may be more familiar with remote play in its current implementation, where people with a PSP and or PS Vita have been able to play their PS3 and or PS4 remotely. This capability will soon be expanded to the PC and Mac family, and I think that is awesome. As heck.
Yeah, that's crazy, but good.
Indeed. But sadly, we do have some doom and gloom.
Yes, we do have some doom and gloom this week. Unfortunately, Versus Evil has pulled Afro Samurai 2 from the PlayStation Store and Steam and given refunds to anyone who has purchased it. CG Magazine spoke to Steve Escalante, who's Versus Evil's general manager, and he was quoted as saying, "The game was a failure. We could not do it in good conscience, Volume 2 and Volume 3, so we've begun the process. It's been a long process to figure it out because Sony has never really had to do it in this way, but we're returning all the money. So across the board, we're putting out an apology saying, sorry about this."
And, you know, I get that this is probably a good choice insofar as many people disliked this game. I know many people disliked this game. It was apparently not a good game. I'm still not feeling great about it being completely removed from the marketplace and even from people's consoles that have it downloaded.
Yeah.
I do not like this. This is like our greatest fear with stuff like PT. You know, we did a whole episode about the digital erasure of games, and I cannot in good conscience talk positively about this process they've begun.
Yeah.
I do not see it as a good thing. It is, I think, a very bad thing itself and sets a bad precedent. So
indeed. And aside from that, we have a few pieces of news that are so controversial. The first one ties in with the recent release of Fallout 4, and it has to do with the Killable Children mod. This is a mod that's based on the Fallout 3 mod from 2008, because Fallout 3, of course, was the first game in the series that left out the option to kill children. And this has just been kind of a debate, you know, now that Fallout 4 has finally arrived. Some people are very happy to be able to, you know, feel like they have a fully immersive experience, even if they don't. Like, a lot of them say, even if I'm not going to kill the children, you know, I'm out on the wasteland in a post-apocalyptic setting, and the, you know, very idea of not being even able to is not right. And then some people, of course, are saying, you know, why do children need to be killed? That's effed up. So it's kind of, you know, I would say a minor controversy within the Fallout fan community.
Well, Slaggy, I'd like to know, what is your opinion on this?
You know, having not really spent a lot of time in the Fallout universe, I can't really comment, but I mean,
you don't have an opinion on a mod that lets you kill children in-game.
No, I mean, I think that it's kind of, you know, upsetting.
Okay, and that's fine. That's an opinion, man. And, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm grilling you. I actually largely agree. This is one of those things where I love mods. I love giving power to the players, so to speak. I love, you know, when simulations are all-encompassing. But at the same time, I really struggle with people going out of their way to kill children.
Yeah.
It might seem silly. I know that these are games, they're digital representations, but, you know, I am something I worry about a lot, actually, is, you know, violence in schools, for example. Like,
right.
And I look at stuff like this, like, I don't want to trivialize the death and murder of children, even in a video game. It just rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah.
I'm glad that modders have the capability and ability to mod. I think that's very cool. But I'm not going to lie, while I would never like stop someone from using a mod like this, I have to say, you know, it just doesn't sit well in my stomach. I could never, I would never. I would find it very upsetting if I were playing at a friend's house and like, blam, kid gets his head blown off, blood everywhere, giant mess, brain bits laying on the ground. That would be an unpleasant experience for me.
Yeah, you know, Patricia Hernandez, the author of this over at Kotaku, was able to bring some good perspective in as a veteran Fallout player. And she mentioned that, you know, in Fallout 2, like, the kids could steal your gear and, like, totally screw your character over, but that kids don't do that anymore. Not that it was, I mean, not that I think it was would even have been okay then, but she's saying, you know, also that, you know, the kids in Fallout 2 with the graphics back then, you know, didn't even really look like real kids. So, you know, she was trying to, you know, kind of understand people's, you know, people who sided with this. So I like that both sides of the controversy were covered.
Yeah, absolutely. Good coverage from Kotaku on this one. And I have to say, you know, I'm saying that in increasing amounts lately, you know, oh, good job from Kotaku. Good job from Kotaku. There was a big controversy this week with Kotaku that I don't think we're going to be talking about here, but I still wanted to shout it out. You know, Kotaku opened up a little bit about the fact that they have actually been experiencing a lockout from several publishers. Ubisoft.
That's actually one of our smashes, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Then we'll get there when we get there. Then instead, let's talk about this other controversial piece.
Yeah, this has been big.
So basically, Dead or Alive Extreme 3, we've talked about this here on the show. Currently, Koei Tecmo is not planning to release it in North America. Finally, a fan asked on Facebook, of all places, when Dead or Alive Extreme 3 would be releasing in North America. And one of the community managers responded on Koei Tecmo's Facebook, you know, basically saying, the game is not, or in fact, I have the full quote here. We do not bring DOA X3 to the West and won't have any plan change in the future. Thank you for asking.
Yeah, and I believe that
a new user asked, all right, what's the reason for not bringing it out West?
Just really quickly, I believe the Dead or Alive game Facebook account is run by Team Ninja community managers, is my understanding of it.
Team Ninja is run by Koei Tecmo.
Oh, I know.
So it's one and the same.
I know. I just wanted to add that. Please continue.
So we have the official response from the community manager. Do you know how many issues happening in video games industry with regard to how treat female in video game industry? We do not want to talk those things here, but certainly we have gone through in last year or two to come to our decision. Thank you. Now, there's obviously a little bit of a language barrier issue here. I don't point that out to make fun, but it's hard to take this necessarily as a definitive statement, but many people have anyway. The way that it has been spun by a certain group of people whom we don't call by name, that social justice warriors are somehow preventing this game from being released. It is being suppressed by those people. Full disclosure, I consider us to be some of those people. Further disclosure, I love the Dead or Alive games, as I've said here on the show, and I love the extreme subseries of Dead or Alive games. We do not have an agenda against this game as we discuss it. So, Psyche, why don't you tell us about the next big step here?
So then, PlayAsia, who, you know, formerly was one of our favorite places to go to import games, made a tweet saying, DOA X3 will not be coming to the U.S. due to SJW nonsense. However, we will have the English Asia version available.
So the first issue here, I'm going to say, you know, first off, hashtag SJW nonsense. You know, the reason why it bothers me, first off, is that there was no SJW agenda against this game. I actually know a lot of supposed SJWs, a lot of people with feminist leanings who all really enjoy the DOA series. Like, seriously. I know that we do often point out the, you know, tropes that the game falls to. We do sometimes point out, you know, when there are representations of women that are you know, exploitative. But there is also some actual really good positive female representation in Dead or Alive. It's actually really cool. There's also some objectification of male characters going on. This game, you know, I know that it's
Dead or Alive just is silliness.
Well, exactly.
You know?
And I know that it's easy for, you know, the opposition, let's say, to paint social justice warriors as hating fun and hating sex, but I will tell you, real talk, the kinkiest, craziest fools I know are like the liberal folks who are trying to push for better representation and you know, more healthy narratives and experiences. But nothing's trying to be quashed. So here's the issue. PlayAsia framed this as though, you know, the opposition should be shopping at their store because those mean SJWs don't want you playing this game. It's some nonsense what they're doing here. And in fact, if you think I'm reading too much into this tweet, PlayAsia, since then, this was on the 24th, so it's been 5 days since then, they are still to this day continuing to egg on and feed into this fire that, frankly, I think we should be fighting to put out. We should all be working on communicating together as a community and working together, not continuing to further this divide for the sake of you exploiting a potential market base that you see. I think that's disgusting. I think it's awful. And unfortunately, it is absolutely working as planned. Apparently, PlayAsia has gotten a ton of sales and
a ton of followers
on Twitter and other various social networking sites.
Yeah.
And it just absolutely has fed the fire. New rounds of people being doxxed, new rounds of people, you know, running their bots to start trash-talking people online. It's fanned the flames to a bad state again.
Yeah, I mean,
for the sake of some fucking money.
To the point where PlayAsia was retweeting things like a Photoshop of Chrono Trigger box art saying Chrono Triggered. You know, making fun of, like, you know, trigger warnings and stuff. And, I mean, to me, that's the PlayAsia part of it is what's really the bothersome part here. Not, you know, the initial response from Koei Tecmo. So, I find it very... And at first, you know, I kind of gave PlayAsia the benefit of the doubt. Not for the tweets. I thought, you know, maybe it's just a community manager gone rogue or whatever, you know, and that PlayAsia would fire them and say, we apologize, you know, for this, blah, blah, blah. But, yep, it's still continuing, so...
They tweeted on the 26th, which gaming sites do you think we would give DOAX3 a fair review if we sent them a copy? We wouldn't want to accidentally trigger anyone. Like, dude, you're making fun of trigger... Like, people get triggered by things. There's literally an entire affliction. There's, you know, a post-traumatic stress disorder. It's a real disorder that really exists. People really get triggered.
Yeah.
This isn't just some new social justice warrior thing. Why is it such a bad thing to give a shit about other people?
To their credit, Koei Tecmo Europe responded to a Twitter user who asked about this whole controversy, and Koei Tecmo Europe said, kudos to the TNCM for being honest, but if you really want it, you can import the English version, unfortunately linking to PlayAsia, but then saying, we said the CM was honest to confirm that it isn't coming to the West. We don't approve that he put the blame on anyone, so... You know, Koei Tecmo Europe does not speak for all of Koei Tecmo or anything like that, but, you know, at least they're trying to right a wrong a little bit.
Yeah, and, you know, I have to say something cool about this release. Did we mention the Asian version of DOAX3 will be in English? It will
have much
an
like
English
that,
language mode.
Extreme versus Force. Title.
Which I was going to bring up in the context that, you know, we're seeing this happen more and more with Gundam games, the Sword Art Online games. We've talked about a number of games here on the show. Increasingly, we're seeing a handful of developers, primarily Namco Bandai and Koei Tecmo, really reaching out to importers and saying, you know, we recognize that you guys import these games. We recognize that, you know, English in these Asian languages increases sales of them. And I think it's really cool that they're putting that forward. Like, hey, you can import this. You can play it. We can't release it in that territory. Now, there's a missing link here, and it's going to get covered in one of the, probably a smash this week, but I still have to bring it up here. That is that US Gamer did a remarkable article basically about why they think this whole social justice nonsense doesn't even play into the release or non-release of DOAX3 in North America, and that more likely, this is because the DOAX series is a huge flop worldwide relative to the core DOA series, and particularly in North America. DOAX2 sold in very, very small numbers in all regions, and in North America in particular, it was a pretty big failure. And more likely than not, this is Koei Tecmo seeing a way that they could pin this game not coming to North America in a way that they wouldn't take the blame for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is something that is very, very much at least worth thinking about.
Yeah. So that article on US Gamer, to kind of move into our smashes, is Dead or Alive Extreme 3, still not releasing in US, Koei Tecmo makes excuses, and Captain Spike, you summed that article up perfectly. It's nice to see, you know, a really in-depth look at, like, what's really going on. You know, the Kotaku article kind of touched upon it, but, you know, it was really more covering the controversy. This is looking at, you know, what's really going on with Dead or Alive? The series doesn't sell. So,
yeah definitely they something we're thinking about. I agree with them. I call shenanigans here, too.
And to move on with our smashes, we actually have three other ones this week. There's just a lot of, you know, I don't know if it was just the holiday season, but there was a lot of good writing to talk about. And this was, the second one is the one that you were alluding to, Captain Spike, which is called A Price of Games Journalism. And that's from Kotaku, Stephen Totilo, the editor-in-chief, basically talking about how Bethesda and Ubisoft have basically blacklisted Kotaku. And, you know, kind of just looking at, you know, the history behind it and how, you know, under his leadership that Stephen Totilo has tried to reach out to these companies. And, you know, with Fallout 4 coming out and Assassin's Creed Syndicate coming out now with, you know, them still being blacklisted, that he's like, look, this is what's going on. So, you know, it might have been backlash from when Brian Crescente was running Kotaku or something, but, you know.
Well, so we actually have a pretty good idea of what happened here. Bethesda has specifically been sort of cut off with Kotaku since they reported in December of 2013, and I believe we talked about this as a rumor has it at the time, that, you know, basically Fallout 4 was a real thing. You may recall in the specific climate of the time then, there were a lot of hoaxes purporting to be the new Fallout project. A lot of people were very disappointed. People were starting to get angry, and Kotaku basically came out like, you know, we've actually seen the script for the game's story. We're not going to publish it all, but believe me, Fallout 4 is a real thing. Basically. And apparently Bethesda was not happy with Kotaku relieving all of these people from these concerns and stresses because they have cut them off since then. Ubisoft apparently went silent after the December 2014 report, and we also talked about this.
Oh, yeah.
On the at-the-time unannounced Assassin's Creed Victory, which went on to be called Assassin's Creed Syndicate. Which, funny enough, that was actually a glowing report, and that report was a big part of why I gave Assassin's Creed Syndicate a chance, finally, and I actually really enjoyed it. So I can actually tell you, like, firsthand, for fact, like, in both of these cases, Kotaku was in, I thought they helped people. I thought that they helped these companies. So it's really funny that, you know, these companies are cutting Kotaku off from doing, you know, journalism, so to speak, and punishing them for, in a really big way, helping them both with press stuff that I don't think they realized was happening. Like, I don't think Ubisoft realizes how much we all dislike Assassin's Creed at this point. Mm-hmm. I don't think Bethesda understood how angry people were getting about all of these fake Fallout projects and Bethesda's insistence on not talking about Fallout 4. That's something that caused people a lot of unpleasant feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny to me that they would have their heads so far up their ass that they would prioritize, like, well, our marketing plan over, like, people being upset and, like, people having unpleasant feelings about these games. Like, no, I'm sorry, your marketing plan is not more important than people's feelings.
Yeah, and he even goes on to say that the only reason they were able to get timely coverage and reviews of both games is because one of their freelance writers was able to write about them. He said, you know, presumably with the hope that he'd cover them for the New York Times, which he also writes for. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of, it makes me side with Kotaku a little more, which is something I did not think I would say when we started this show. You know, I've really more and more come to embrace Kotaku is kind of like more an, I guess they're kind of, from the start, were always meant more like a blog than, you know, like a game news site. So, you know, like,
well, and that for me has always been a part of my complaint with Kotaku, is that they've, for a long time there, and less so now, but for a long time there, they were trying to present themselves as, like, the face of video game news. And I really felt like they were trying to push themselves as, like, games news. Despite doing, you know, some of their sillier posts and being technically a blog, I really didn't feel like they represented themselves as an independent voice. But now we're getting all of these exposés, we're getting investigative pieces, and it's really getting to the point now where I've long said that I think we need articles like this, stuff like when they went and did like a whole retelling of like the lengthy development process and development woes of Destiny.
Yeah.
Those are important things for us to read. I both as a gamer, you know, because I want to know, why didn't Destiny turn out to be the game I was expecting? Which should not be taken as a complaint against Destiny. I love it, but anyone will tell you the game we got is not the game they were selling us right at conferences for years. And so you read something like that, and to me it actually helps even with like gamer perception of the game, because it's like, okay, now I see why I'm not playing that. I'm not mad about it anymore, because now I can appreciate the game that we did get released.
Right.
And further from that, for people who are interested in getting into the industry, it's important to know this is how these things work.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to continue growing the industry, we want to continue bringing in fresh, new, you know, fantastic talent, they need to have accurate representations available of what it's really like to work on these things. So I absolutely view what Kotaku is doing in the modern age, I absolutely view it as important and essential. I think we need more voices like that in games journalism, and it's very disheartening to me to see Bethesda and Ubisoft cutting Kotaku out of the loop in punishment for things that really Ubisoft and Bethesda should have been doing. Yeah,
trying to actually report. You know, we were talking about this before the show, that, you know, a lot of the other gaming news sites out there, you know, occasionally will have a good feature, and, you know, we love Silicon Era for giving us all of those left of center pieces of news that, you know, about Japanese gaming and stuff, but, you know,
maybe aren't on our radar, but most definitely should be.
Exactly. But, you know, that otherwise, most of these other gaming news sites are very like, you know, oh, we got paid to write nice things about this, and it's like very clear, you know, or that it's just, you know, very, you know, surface level news without any sort of real weight to it. So
yeah, well, increasingly the various games news sites seem to just be PR mouthpieces
pretty much,
and the reality is a lot of people are, it appears, are
here's
okay
an exclusive
with
first look at blah blah blah,
but I'm not okay with that. I don't like that. I don't think it's good for anyone for the reasons I just detailed, and I'm of all the people to side with, I never thought I'd be siding with Kotaku, but here we are
in a lighter piece of news, or not really news, you know, in a lighter discussion article, AV Club has a really cool interview called "What Was It Like to Be a Nintendo Gameplay Counselor?" And it talks to a handful of the Nintendo Gameplay Counselors from the late 80s to early 90s, where you could call in and get game help. And it's just really a neat little, you know, slice of life for something that, you know, our generation remembers, that, you know, newer generations might not be as familiar with. I think it's a really cool little piece of history. And, you know, it's the type of thing that we like to see in our gaming media, our gaming journalism, you know. I love these historical looks. And, you know, there's some really cool anecdotes about, you know, Nintendo at the time, and just kind of tying in with, you know, our recent look at the history of Nintendo and our Ninty 90s. I just thought it was a really cool read. So, you know, I mean, I'm going to leave it to y'all if you're interested to read it for the details, but I like seeing things like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that this is really cool, you know, getting a perspective that I hadn't had previously on a service that, frankly, I wasn't even super familiar with how it functioned. It's just really cool to read this sort of thing. And, you know, to see some of their images of like what it looked like and stuff it's really neat. It's really cool
indeed. And this last one is something that that you had wanted to include, so I'll let you kind of take the lead on this one.
So I don't really want to paraphrase the entire article in this case. It's just, I thought, a really well-written piece on Kotaku once again. It's called "The Problem with the Post-Bungie Halo Campaigns." And it basically just goes down the list for why, you know, while 343 Industries' later attempts at Halo as games are, you know, starting to really come together, starting to be good experiences, they're still missing something. And this article is just a really thoughtful essay on sort of the different game design and story writing styles that really come across in the 343 Industries in a very different way in their games, in a very different way than the Bungie games presented these things. You know, obviously 343i is starting to get some of the level design stuff down, but some of the story stuff they still don't seem to understand, and it's really damaging the overall public perception of the Halo series in a lot of ways. I thought it was a fantastic read, and I actually came away from it. You know, I've talked here on the show about how I like Halo, I think Halo's really good. It's, for me, for a long time, was like the one AAA franchise that every year you could rely on I'd be playing. I wouldn't be playing any other AAA game, but Halo I'd be playing. And now that's a little less true than it used to be, and reading this article really helped me to put in towards why that is. So I thought it was a cool read. I was really, really surprised that, you know, they had put together this article, but I was super into it, and I think you might be too.
Yeah. I mean, as someone who's not as intimately familiar with the Halo games, it was really interesting to see how the story beats have basically completely changed from what Bungie has established. So, yeah, Destiny. But this is not Destiny Buoy. This is Animal Crossing Buoy this week. So we are going to be talking about Dobutsu no Mori, or Animal Forest, as it's known in Japan. And, you know, we just had two recent releases not too long ago, in this series, so we thought it was a timely time to talk about this series that is just really, you know, in a lot of ways, I think a lot of people just think of it as cute little animals talking to each other, but the thing I really hope to do today is look at, you know, some of the really cool things that the series has done, and, you know, how it experiments with play and that sort of thing. So we're going to go ahead and get started. I wanted to start by talking about some of the key figures involved in Animal Crossing. The first person is Katsuya Iguchi-san, who's been around in Nintendo for a long time. You know, started out as a designer on Super Mario Bros. 3, director of Star Fox, Wave Race 64, and then was the director of the majority of the Animal Crossing entries up until New Leaf, pretty much. And so, you know, this is someone who'd really, you know, been involved with a lot of classic Nintendo games and really kind of worked his way up, as we've seen in Nintendo. Another person who was very prominent in the Animal Crossing series was Takashi Tezuka, better known as Tenten to many of us. And, you know, Tenten has been involved in many, many things. You know, Legend of Zelda was really, you know, helped out a lot with the original Super Mario Brothers, was the director of Super Mario Brothers 2, Mario 3, Mario World, A Link to the Past. I mean, you know, Tenten is huge in Nintendo's history.
Yeah, Tezuka-san is, I think, one of the pillars, you could say, of, you know, what we think of as Nintendo from a game design standpoint. I mean, he was assistant director on Super Mario Brothers and game designer on the original Super Mario Brothers, as well as, you know, what we think of as Super Mario Brothers The Lost Levels. He was the director on that title, and obviously game designer. So, you know, already at the very beginning of what we think of as Nintendo's, like, peak video game, like, entering sort of where Nintendo came into power as a games developer, he was there at the forefront. He was directing these games, worked as a director on Mario 3, Legend of Zelda, Super Mario World, Link to the Past, Link's Awakening, Yoshi's Island, did design work, of course, for the Saddle of You spin-off of Zelda. You know, he was one of the assistant directors of Mario 64, did supervisor work on Star Fox 64, is credited as the primary producer on Yoshi's Story. I mean, come on. Like, this guy has had his fingers in the pie of so many of, like, the landmark Nintendo games.
Yeah,
so,
and I wanted to bring up Tenten, you know, because for the Animal Crossing series, he's been the producer for pretty much all of the mainline Animal Crossing games. So, you know, by that time, the, you know, year 2000-ish, even like you said, Yoshi's Story. So towards the end of the 90s, he was already, you know, moving up to a producer role. And then, of course, I'd like to mention Kazumi Totaka-san, who is the composer. And, you know, if you know the Totaka's theme, the whole deal around that, you know, he's well known for that. So, I mean, Mario Paint, of course, is what, you know, we associate him a lot with. But he's had a lot to do with the sound design for the Animal Crossing games. So, you know, and something that's also really cool is KK Slider, Totakeke in the Japanese version, is named in honor of him. So he kind of has a very special tie. And of course, in the modern era, we want to mention Aya Kyogoku Ayaku Goku-san, and she is the newest director of the Animal Crossing series, so she's taking the helm from Eguchi-san, and really kind of it represents the future of Animal Crossing. So, we talked about that a little at E3, about how cool it is that a lot more, we're seeing a lot more women developers and game directors in Nintendo, so we're really, as we'll talk about today, I think that she's really trying to bring the series in new directions in a positive way.
Something I really like about Kyogoku-san is that she actually came up working on Japanese Dreamcast and PlayStation 2 JRPGs, Dysperia, Wizardry, that kind of stuff. And then she came on writing scripts for example, Twilight Princess, Four Swords Adventure, both for the, Nintendo GameCube, and she actually got brought up to sequence director for Animal Crossing City Folk in the Wii era before being named director of New Leaf. So she very rapidly ascended.
Right.
But, she's a brilliantly talented woman, and I think it's fantastic, as Slaggy said, that we do see a woman rising the ranks like this. It's, it didn't used to be a very common thing, particularly in Japanese business, and it's really cool to see Nintendo, letting this happen, giving this woman the opportunity and being rightly rewarded for her awesome insights and takes on sort of how more specifically the more recent Animal Crossing games can do things.
Yeah. So for those of you who may not be familiar with Animal Crossing, kind of the overview of all of the mainline games is that you're a human character who moves into a little village in the forest area where there are animals that live there. And there's not really, it's really open-ended. It's not like a, really quest-based, or, there's not, like, an overarching story. You just, interact.
Think of it as The Sims for furries, IDK.
Now.
I didn't mean that with any negativity to Sims fans or furries. Just, yeah. I mean, it's literally build a little city, make your home look super cute, impress your AI animal friends.
Yep, you can collect, plant, and they all use internal clocks and calendars to have real-time things happen. So there's seasonal changes, holidays, and, one of the things that players like about the Animal Crossing series is that there's so much customization. Like you mentioned, you build your house up the way you want to, and, you even have the ability to determine, like, catchphrases, the song, the anthem of your town, and, I mean, you even have control over which animals are in your village, because if you don't like them, you can just like ignore them or be mean to them, which kind of sounds sad, but there's that level of control. And then, like we said, collecting, there's fishing, there's like paintings and fossils. You could send mail to characters in game, or also other players. So it's a lot about interaction, and communication has really kind of been the key, focus of Animal Crossing, whether that's with communication with the AI characters or with human characters. So before we talk about the, individual games themselves and kind of the history of that, I just wanted to, shout out some of the notable characters that we associate with the series. Tom Nook, probably being kind of one of the characters that we really identify most closely with Animal Crossing. He started out as a shopkeep. He ran a little store, and then eventually left his sons to run the store while he became the realtor of the town. Kind of, you always had to pay your housing payments to him, but he really kind of graduated into being a real estate agent. Tortimer the mayor was also a prominent one until New Leaf, which, spoiler alert, you become the mayor in New Leaf. But, he's also a figure that is very well known with the series. The Able Sisters are adorable little hedgehogs that run the clothing design store. So you can, design your own clothes in some of the later games. And, they sell all the different clothing items. KK Slider is a musician, and all the characters love him. He's basically Bay. Pete the Pelican is a mail carrier. So, definitely part of that communication element. There's Lyle, who is an adorable otter, who starts out as an insurance agent and then later is part of the Happy Home Academy, which rates your home and kind of looks at the feng shui of it and such, which, it doesn't ultimately matter, but, if you want your home to be highly rated and such, kind of should follow his feedback. And then there's Mr. Resetti. He's a mole, and he will yell at you if you reset your game. There's not really, any serious implications, but he gets cranky at you. And then in New Leaf, there have been some very beloved new additions. That's Cyrus and Reese. They are alpaca. You know, alpaca are very popular in Japan and with Captain Spike. And they run a little store called Retail in New Leaf, which lets you upholster your furniture and also serves as a pawn shop. And then, who's arguably become the new mascot of Animal Crossing, is Isabel, an adorable dog who is your assistant in New Leaf and is, you know, becoming very prominent in the more recent games. So with that, we're going to start talking about the games themselves. The first Animal Crossing game was Animal Forest in Japan for the N64, so Dobutsu no Mori. This was in April 2001, and it was originally developed for the 64DD, so they wanted to kind of take advantage of the 64DD's real-time clock, and then, you know, all the problems with the 64DD, we kind of talked a little bit about that in our Nintendo 64 episode a while back, but, you know, after they had
And this was less about the specific problems with the 64DD as a device, and just more to do with this very simple fact that the 64 was delayed repeatedly,
yeah,
and this game was ready to go.
So what they ended up doing was putting a real-time clock inside of the game cartridge, which, you know, it kind of was I wouldn't say like a feat of engineering, but, you know, I thought that was really cool that they, you know, made that work. We kind of think of like the Pokemon Gold and Silver is also having clocks built into their cartridges. So it was very soon after ported to GameCube on December 14th, 2001 in Japan as Animal Forest Plus. It had some extra features, and this version used the GameCube built-in clock, so didn't need it, obviously, a special cartridge because GameCube was the first disc-based system. And, you know, the in-game clock allowed, like we said, the passage of time and even between game sessions. So, like, you know, you could be gone for the rest of the day and then come play your game, and it's at night. And so it kind of had the slogan, the real-life game that's playing even when you're not. And so, you know, Nintendo of America liked what they saw and started to localize it as Animal Crossing. And they actually had to do a bunch of translation. You know, they translated thousands of lines of text, and they also created new holidays and items. And the Nintendo Treehouse members, Nate Bildhorf and Rich Amtower, if you're familiar with those names, they really kind of got their prominence, you know, in the Treehouse. You know, those of us who follow Nintendo, that was like kind of something that was really like where they really kind of made their name from my understanding. And Nintendo of Japan actually liked that so much that like their additions and like what they created and added, that they actually went and added those things in along with some of their other own additions as Animal Forest E Plus. So we in North America got Animal Crossing on September 15th, 2002. It came out in 2003 in the Australia, Oceania region, and in Europe, it didn't come out until 2004. It also got a Chinese release on the IQ player in 2006, interestingly. But, yeah, so this game was, as we know as Animal Crossing over here, was more or less what the original Animal Forest was, you know, just with additions. And the GameCube, of course, had connectivity with the Game Boy Advance. So that was something that was really cool that allowed you, using the link cable, to go on to a tropical island, and you could collect coconuts and decorate a beach house. And you were also able to use the GBA to do pattern design with the Able Sister. So that's something that actually was available early on, but if you didn't have the GBA link cable, you weren't able to access that functionality, as far as I recall.
And can I just talk about how, you know, I didn't play a lot of Animal Crossing. I actually don't really care for the Animal Crossing series very much, but
boo.
I really felt, excuse you,
sorry,
I would never do that to you.
Sorry.
So I would use the GameCube, Game Boy Advance link cable, which, you know, I talk about it all the time, playing Four Swords and all that. I always felt like going to the island really broke the game. Like, I would make so much money from the fruit on the island, or I'm sorry, make so much bells that, like, I'd come back and it's like, oh, I just started playing, but I've already paid off my most recent loan from Tom Nook. Like, it just completely broke the economy of the game in my experience. It was very easily exploitable.
And I feel like the later games blocked off the island until later on, so that I think for that very reason, because I definitely have noticed that, you know, the island is a great place to get some good bells, which is the currency, of course. And, You know, I'm going to try and keep this moving pretty quickly, but my original experience, I didn't actually own the original Animal Crossing, but I had friends in college who...
When you say original Animal Crossing, you mean the GameCube version that we got released in North America. Okay.
They had it, and so I made a character in their village, and, you know, in the original Animal Crossing game for GameCube, you were able to visit each other's towns.
You lived in the same town. You could visit each other's houses.
And visit each other's houses, thank you. It was stored on the memory card. So, you know, I definitely had a lot of fun there, and I just was entranced by, you know, the adorable animals, and it's just a very quaint, cute game. It's, you know, Nintendo has a reputation of being, you know, like, for kids, childlike, but, you know, it's just this very cute and playful, and, I mean, it's been that way from the start. Now, something that Captain Spike, that I know you love, and that I'll let you talk about a little bit, is that there were 15 NES games emulated on the cartridge, and then there were a couple more available with a memory card.
Well, so the thing is, a lot of us actually looked at this, you know, including NES games in Animal Crossing. Looking back, a lot of us view this as almost like a proto-virtual console.
Right.
You need to remember, you know, in this time period, we didn't see Nintendo doing what now feels like, you know, the constant re-releasing of older content. So the idea of playing NES Mario Brothers or Super Mario Brothers or Zelda or, you know, Excitebike and soccer, you know, it felt like a very cool forward-thinking idea to be playing these on our GameCubes in their original form, which obviously, you know, you think about it now, it's like, what? But this was actually such a big selling point at the release of Animal Crossing that it actually came packaged in North America with a memory card that would give you, the player, two NES games upon starting a new game file on that memory card. And, you know, then you, through playing the game, you know, your neighbors and friends would start gifting you NES games as you played through. You know, I did mention Zelda and Super Mario Brothers. It's worth mentioning that while these games do exist on the disc code, Super Mario Brothers was only distributed in Japan to Famitsu readers, and Zelda, while it, again, is fully there in the game's code and you can easily hack into it, it doesn't actually have, like, an official legit way of accessing, of being accessed within the game. However, stuff like Clue Clue Land or whatever, those games you could access. I think Punch-Out was one. I seem to recall Wario's Woods, maybe.
When I was doing my research,
I
was having trouble locating a complete list.
Well, and that was part of the fun back then was, you know, me and all my friends, many of us bought this game not even interested in the game. Like, we just wanted to access this NES game mechanic. So, which is, you know, now it seems silly. But again, at the time, this was the primary reason of buying this game for many of us was, you know, fuck this animal life sim. I just want access to NES games on my GameCube. So... I just thought that was a really interesting sidebar, and you know, it's very interesting to me that Nintendo very specifically took advantage of, you know, using this functionality by, you know, giving you a memory card with two games on it that you'll unlock when you make a save on that card. Like, that is a very specifically a calculated ploy to leverage people who are interested in this functionality.
Yeah.
So it's just, to me, a very interesting footnote in Animal Crossing's success.
Indeed. And, you know, it was very successful. It was the sixth best-selling GameCube game. It sold 3.15 million. It sold approximately 3.15 million units from the sales data I was able to find. And, you know, most of those were in the U.S. because, I mean, you know, U.S. has a larger population. But, you know, it definitely drove the sales, like you said. And so, yeah, like I said, my experience was mostly limited to playing it with friends. But where I really got into it, and I have an anecdote that I might have shared before on the show, but I'm sharing it again, is with the DS release of Animal Crossing Wild World. This came out November 23rd, 2005 for Japanese region. North America got it December 5th, 2005. Australia got it December 8th, 2005. And Europe got it March 31st, 2006. Yeah, we're not kidding when we say that Europe's always had to wait. And something that's kind of interesting, you know, we talked a little bit about the immense localization work that had to be done in the original Animal Crossing. And so when development began for Wild World, they decided to make nothing region specific. So like any holidays based on Halloween, Christmas, Sakura Festival for the Japanese version, even like the different fish and insects were not included if they were region specific, just to make the localization easier.
And the funny thing about that is, you know, I know a lot of people whose initial exposure to Sakura Festival flower viewing, Hanami, is actually through Animal Crossing.
Yeah.
So it's sort of funny in that by homogenizing the game from a design standpoint a little bit, they still ended up, sharing some regional culture with people. I think that's a really interesting, you know, way to look at that.
Mm-hmm. Some of the things that were added in Wild World were the ability to draw constellations for the night sky. And, you know, being a DS game, it, like, definitely helps with the inventory management on the touchscreen, writing messages, designing clothes, even moving the player character. And it also allowed the developers to kind of use a what's termed as a rolling log effect instead of rather just like a top-down perspective, which allowed you to see the sky and the terrain on the ground kind of at the same time.
And I have to say, you know, I actually love that effect. I'm not a big Animal Crossing fan, but I actually love the game's aesthetic.
Yeah.
I think that it's a very well-realized style of and design of art. I think it all comes together in a really cohesive way. And that rolling log style, while in photos it doesn't maybe look that good, when you're moving around your world and it's rotating that way, I actually just think it's a really good presentation for this kind of game.
And being a DS title was also the first Animal Crossing game to include online play using the Nintendo Wi-Fi connection. You know, all the friend code business. So you couldn't connect to random players, but you'd be able to invite your friends over to explore your village or go to their villages. And you could also exchange items and patterns, and you could also get gifts from Nintendo. We're going to talk about Animal Crossing City Folk for the Wii in a little bit, and so it also had compatibility, including you could also transfer your character from Wild World to City Folk when that came out.
That's awesome.
And, you know, unfortunately, like we talked about on the show last year, the Nintendo Wi-Fi connection is no longer available, so you can't do any of the online play, any matchmaking or leaderboard things that were available in that title. Something that was kind of an interesting little tidbit, a little piece of game history. I always am interested in like game glitches, you know, notable game glitches. There's that one in World of Warcraft that was really notable. There was one in Wild World.
Which
actually.
One in World of Warcraft?
Well, you know, the virus from Zul'Garub.
Oh, the infected blood.
Right. So this was not as serious as... Well, I mean, it kind of was. This was called Red Tulips, and it was sent to people who were connected to the Wi-Fi connection. It was a glitch item called Red Tulips that corrupted your game save data, and if you placed it on the floor in your house, it made, like, this invisible wall that basically, it made that spot in your house useless. And so it was just caused by a bug. It was not like a hacker. It was something to do with the upload tool that they used to send the Wi-Fi connection gifts. So they said, if you got that letter, delete it. So
delete it.
It was the 29th best-selling game of Japan in the year 2008. As of earlier this year, the sales numbers have come in at 11.74 million copies worldwide. So sold over 300,000 copies its first week in Japan alone. It was the best-selling DS title until the release of Brain Age 2. So, you know, we hear 29th best-selling game, but that's in 2008, 3 years after its release. And, you know, DS had a lot of games compared to, like, you know, the GameCube. So my experience with Wild World is, you know, this is where I really first got into it. I was using the name Slagkick online already, so my character was Slagkick, and the town was Gargyle. My town song was Holla Back Girl, because that was right around that era. And I was in college at the time, and I basically skipped class for a week when it came out to hang out with my friends in the student union to play it. So we'd be on campus. There was no reason why I couldn't have gone to class. I skipped class to be like, oh, I just got some new pears in my town. Do you have durian fruits yet? or, you know, things like that. And I mean, it was just really addictive. You know, the one thing that is kind of the unfortunate thing about the Animal Crossing games is that once you stop playing for a while, you know, your town gets overgrown and your favorite animals move away. So that's always kind of a bummer, something that's not really been solved yet, you know, in my opinion. But, you know, definitely it does give you an incentive to keep playing if you want to. So, you know, it definitely was just a, you know, a short burst of time. And I'd say that's kind of true for all of the Animal Crossing games for me. But, you know, I was obsessed for quite a while. And Captain Spike still tells people, oh, my God, you won't believe what he did when Animal Crossing Wild World came out.
It's hilarious to me. You cut school for this game.
I did.
Don't get me wrong. I cut school so many times for Dungeons and Dragons and stuff. I mean, I'm not, like, judging you or whatever. It's just funny to me.
Oh, because I was, because, you know, when you first met me, I was, like, straight A student, you know, like, obsessed with, you know, doing my best at school, and I'm like, eh.
Well, that it was Animal Crossing that did that to you was like, what?
Yep, Animal Crossing unleashed my dark side.
That is so funny. Because, again, you know, to me, Animal Crossing was proto-virtual console. Like, it as a game was just like, are you kidding me? People like this? This is nonsense. And, you know, I have to be honest, I still don't really get it. I buy every one of these games in the hope that, you know, this will be the one. This will be the one that clicks for me. But it hasn't happened yet.
I'm going to call you out on that at the end of the show.
Okay.
What was your experience with Wild World? I know we played together.
You know, I played Wild World for about a week. I will say, you know, you make it sound when you say that you took a week off of school, you make it sound like it was just a week, but you were playing that game for a hell of a lot longer than a week.
Yeah, it was just one week of classes that I cut.
The event of you missing a week was like a month after I was completely over the game, which for me might have been part of why I was like, what? Because for me, I got Animal Crossing, playing it on the DS, taking my DS to work every day, getting into it. But it was just like, after a week of it, it's just like, okay, well, I've gotten some bugs, I've gotten some fish, I made a little lawn in front of my house. Well, I'm so bored. And that's still really where I'm at with the series. You know, it does not hold my interest. I'm not terribly interested in this kind of game design. The animals are super cute. Their little fictitious language is super cute. The way they clap their little paws is super cute. But from a gameplay perspective, it offers very little for someone like me.
All right. Well, the next game in the series was 2008's Animal Crossing City Folk, known in Europe and Oceania regions as Animal Crossing Let's Go to the City. This came out in the USA first on November 16th, 2008, kind of a testament to how many of us in the States love this series. Canada got it the next day, November 17th. Japan got it November 20th. And then Australia got it December 4th. Europe got it December 5th. So, you know, all of the regions getting it pretty close in proximity of each other. Some of the changes for City Folk were that the players live in individual houses rather than, the houses, they always lived in individual houses, but in the original Animal Crossing, so let me take a step back. In the first Animal Crossing, the player houses were in a central plaza. In Wild World, you shared the house. But now in City Folk, the houses were all kind of spread apart in the town. And there also was a new addition to the clothing design. You can make a separate image on the front of the back of clothes and the sleeves rather than the same design on each part of it. And one of the big things to return was some holiday characters. So, you know, a lot of the holidays that had been taken out in Wild World came back in City Folk. So there was like a Easter Bunny Festival, and those were new characters to join. And there was Nat the Chameleon, who has the bug off, the bug catching contest, which is, you know, I think one of the most fun parts of the game. And it also added the city. You know, it was called City Folk, so you can take a bus there to buy clothes, get your hair did, go to the movies, get some furniture, you can get your shoes polished, buy kicks. It allowed you to use the Wii Speak microphone to do voice chat over the Wi-Fi connection, and it also allowed, you know, text chat with a USB keyboard. There was an auction house by Lloyd the Gyroid, and the office for the Happy Home Academy, as we mentioned with Lyles, which you can see kind of the progression of other players' towns. So these, of course, the Wi-Fi connection features are no longer available, but when it was available, there was some downloadable content from Wii Connect 24. You might remember that functionality, including a red Pikmin hat. There was Girls' Day updo, St. Patrick's Day hat. Nintendo of America got a hot dog hat. A dolphin from Pikmin, a dresser that was shaped like a GameCube, a Wii locker, so just like cute little items. As we mentioned, it supported DS connectivity. You could import your character from Wild World, including the character's face, their hair color, hairstyle, and the catalog items purchasable from Tom Nook. You did not get your items or bells or house, unfortunately. But it kind of let you bring over some of your, the essence of your character, which is cool. And so I didn't spend a whole lot of time with City Folk, but, you know, it did, you know, move it a little bit forward, iterated on the series. But something that's really notable about City Folk is that when journalists got sent press copies for review, they were also sent copies of Wild World to kind of show the functionality, the connectivity of it. And so MTV had reported that their copy of Wild World had a racial slur, kind of like, you know, edited with custom characters, you know, like foreign characters, accents and stuff. And so that was kind of a big controversy back then. And because it was using, like, you know, different accented characters, it was not, you know, caught by the profanity detection system. And so that was like a really embarrassing snafu on Nintendo's part. They, you know, apologized, and it actually was caused by a wireless function that allowed the catchphrases between games to be passed. And I remember, like, you know, I remember when I would play Wild World that it would do that. So if I was saying, like, yo, what up, bae? You know, this was before the time of bae or whatever, but that if I visited another town, or, you know, other people visited my town, that they might be saying bae in the other town or whatever. So
yeah, and that was cool. You know, I'd always teach mine to just be like, yo, what up? I mean, because, you know, I was a big nerd. I didn't have anything, like, devious. I was trying to teach no one. I didn't have no cool slang or nothing. So I was just like, yo, what up? And then it would be super funny. People would be like, all of my animals are talking like you now.
Yeah, right? Yeah, so unfortunately, it had ended up with a racial slur in it, and that was a kind of a drama, unfortunately. But it was one of the top 20 selling Wii games, with 4.32 million sales worldwide.
Fantastic.
And the most recent in the mainline series of games is Animal Crossing New Leaf, which that was, you know, in the era of Game Buoy. In Japan, it was known as Animal Forest Jump Out, and this was released in 2012, November 8th, 2012 in Japan. Korea got it February 7th, 2013, and then the Western parts of the world got it in June 2013. And I remember that because I bought it on the day that we went to the E3 experience and played Super Mario 3D World and Mario Kart 8 for the first time. And this is the most recent mainline series game. And so it really kind of enhanced the customization features. You can modify your pants, shirt, shoes, hats, accessories. You can hang furniture on walls. Things that had been removed from previous games, like benches and lampposts, are back. You can swim in the ocean. You know, Nintendo Network allows you to visit other towns and add your friends to their friend lists. And you can bring friends to Tortimer Island, because Tortimer, the mayor, has retired to an island, and you are now the mayor. And so this kind of added some really cool things, like public works projects, and that let you, you know, build bridges or other things, statues and such, and ordinances that allowed you to pass laws. You could do things like make the shops open later if you were, like, you know, unable to play early in the day because of work or whatever. So that's pretty cool. And, you know, really kind of enhanced the things like the Happy Home Showcase, lets you see, like, other players' street pass houses. You can get furniture from a catalog. You can use QR codes to find designs for other people's clothing and such. You can use play coins to buy fortune cookies. And, you know, so it's the most recent one, and the one that we, you know, so it's kind of our most, you know, recent talking point for the mainline game. And so what they actually did is they tried to do different research. What they did to kind of personalize it for people in different parts of the world is they researched customs and holidays from around the world and then included them exclusive to those regions. So
sort of the opposite of what we had seen earlier in the series.
Exactly. So the example that one notable example is that on New Year's Eve in Japan, you eat buckwheat noodles. In North America, the English version, you pop some bubbly. Or if you're playing the Spanish language version, either in Europe or North America, you eat a dozen grapes at midnight. So I think that's just a really cute touch that, you know, makes it culturally relevant. And, you know, it's a fun game, you know. So I kind of faded off from playing it shortly after, but, you know, I definitely had a lot of fun, and kind of talking about it makes me kind of want to go visit my town again.
Well, you know, we were playing Animal Crossing Amiibo Festival this past weekend, you know, over the long holiday, and everyone who was playing was kind of like, ooh, I could see myself going back to Animal Crossing. Unfortunately, I mean, I'm not going to. The game actively punishes you for coming back to it. As Slaggy had mentioned earlier, you know, I don't want to turn Animal Crossing back on because I know my town's going to be overtaken by weeds. All of my little animal friends are going to be writing me angry notes. A couple of them will be like, oh, I missed you. And other ones are going to be like, excuse me, aren't you the mayor? What are you doing? So honestly,
nice to see you back. Isabel will probably be like, oh, Mayor, you're back.
Yeah, I'm not turning on Animal Crossing just so my animal friends can be passive-aggressive
guilt
dicks.
Trip.
I'm not into it.
Yeah, but I mean, I still think that it's a cute game. It's very fully featured, you know, compared to the earlier entries. And what I really am excited for is the new direction that, you know, I don't know, I say new direction. We had two spinoffs that, you know, we've talked about on the show that were coming up this year, and they are both out now. The first one being Happy Home Designer, which came out in September here in North America. It had been available for a while out in Japan and since July, and then early October is when Europe and Australia got it. And you know, I talked about it when I was doing my What's Up. It's cute. It definitely improves the home design process using the touchscreen. It's a lot less cumbersome, but for a full game, I kind of feel like, you know, there's not too much there. So it's very cute. You can use the amiibo cards to, you know, bring in animals and design homes for them, and that, you know, includes like some of the notable characters like Tom Nook and KK Slider. But you know, it's I feel like it's a little more of an experiment, and Aya Kyogoku-san has been very clear about the fact that this is, you know, a spinoff, and you know, I appreciate it more after kind of reading a little more about it. And she has been quoted as saying, you know, we had to think about what kind of theme would this animal like, what kind of life do they lead, and we try to think of a way we could get this kind of experience to players as well. So, you know, just kind of thinking about, you know, just different player experiences, and you're just experimenting with amiibo. I think my one thing is just saying that, you know, I just think that maybe at a little bit lower price point, not to be, you know, that sort of person, but I feel like there, at least in my experience with it so far, there's not a huge game experience. It just feels kind of more like something that I hope will be in the next mainline entry, you know, with the elements of designing the houses, and being able to design other characters' houses is cute, but I mean, there's not really much more than that.
You know, it's funny because you say that, and it's like, I guess as an Animal Crossing fan, I can see how you feel that way, but I bought Amiibo Festival. I like Amiibo Festival. I would buy an Amiibo Festival too. Like, I would probably not be inclined to buy another Animal Crossing though, and if this mode was just relegated to like sub mode in a different game, I probably wouldn't have played it. So I don't know. I thought it was good to reach out. I enjoyed it. It felt like an entire Animal Crossing experience shoved into like a little 1 hour block of casual play.
Okay, well let's talk about Amiibo Festival then. I was still wrapping
okay,
up.
Okay,
well,
wrap up. We'll get there then. Wrap. You finish your wrap up, and then we can talk about Amiibo Festival.
Just the other thing being that, you know, it kind of frees you to design your design dream homes, because you don't have to spend money. So it's kind of just like a home design fun time. So it's cute, but like I said, something that I'd wait unless you're a hardcore Animal Crossing fan, I'd probably wait until it drops price a little bit before picking it up. Or unless you just have a huge roster of amiibo cards that you, like, you know, you've been collecting, you know, then maybe it might be worth it.
And see, this to me, and I do actually want to build on that, because, you know, I was talking about Animal Crossing Amiibo Festival because I thought that was a spinoff that you were moving on to talking about.
Yes, but and we are.
I want to say also about Happy Home is that, again, the scoring and, like, doing things correctly, like, that, it to me, is a more compelling play mechanic that I like it being pushed off to the side of one of the core games. That, for me, the more I read about it, the more I'm like, okay, well, this is the kind of game experience that would work for me a little more.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, like, the completely free form, completely just, like, everything is open world, open roll. You could just play Animal Crossing by laying in a field somewhere and doing nothing, I guess. And still the little animal world would happen around you. I'm not super into that. I like goals. I like having objectives and being scored on my performance.
And that's fair, yeah. I definitely can agree with that.
So I think it's cool just, to have it split off a little bit.
I feel in my experience, I haven't found anything challenging where they've been like, no, that doesn't quite suit my vision.
And you know, I'll admit, like I said, I have not actually played Happy Home Designer. I nearly bought a copy just to try it, you know, while doing some reading for this episode. But it's, again, I think it's cool that we're getting these spinoffs that do different things with the idea. And the idea of cramming it all back into the core game package, for me, is like, I'm never going to experience it there.
Okay, that's fair. So let's talk about Amiibo Festival then. It just came out. North America got it first on November 13th. And Europe, Japan, and Australia got it on November 20th, November 21st, and November 21st, respectively. So, you know, this one was really interesting because up until a point, all we knew about it was that it was a little board game party game. You know, obvious comparisons to Mario Party without the mini games, using the amiibo figure. And Kyoko Kusan actually said, honestly, we just wanted Animal Crossing amiibo and we wanted the company to make Animal Crossing amiibo. So that's why we made a game that works with them. And so, you know, up until the release, we really didn't know much about it, like other modes or anything. And I was actually a little reluctant, you know, but I was a little wary of, you know, what this might
hesitant?
Be. A little hesitant, yeah. But it's really cute. The way that I would describe it that, you know, we were kind of talking about when we were playing it is it really feels like playing Animal Crossing as a board game. So, you know, you go around, you roll the dice, and, you know, you might land on a happy space. So then, like, there's a little event that happens to your character, like, oh, I went to Club LOL and watched Dr. Shrunk's comedy routine, and then you get happy points. Or, oh, I was cleaning out my house and I found some bells, and then you get bells added. And then there's things like, you know, the stock market with Sao Joan. you know, and the prices of the stock market fluctuate throughout, you know, the week, or, you know, one week might be good, one week might be bad. So it almost has like a Fortune Street element to it. So there's actually, you know, it's still, I would say, pretty simple, but it was a lot of fun, just really cute to see, you know, the different animals interacting. And then when something sad would happen, it was like, oh, so, you know, still a simple game, but I don't feel like, you know, the 2 hours that we spent on it, you know, playing, you know, two rounds of the board game were wasted at all. I've had a delightful time.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I've been, you know, playing it throughout the long weekend, like I had mentioned previously. I enjoy it. You know, there's a lot of controversy. The game is a regular retail price game, comes with two amiibos. The game itself is a little anemic. You know, these are facts. And, you know, people who require, like, oh, I must get X number of hours for a $60 game, like, those of you who feel that way about games, it's unlikely that you're going to get a worthwhile experience out of this game. Those of you who are just going to look at a game based on its own merit in a vacuum, I actually think there's a really great time to be had with Amiibo Festival. It, for me, was very easy to, you know, basically you play for 1 hour, essentially, with three people. We're playing with three. I don't know how that would scale up or down. I'd assume with two people, it'd be a little shorter. With four people, it'd be just a little longer. But I found it to be a very pleasant experience. It was like Mario Party, but without, like, the mini games and more focused on, like, just being a really cute, chill, kickback time.
Yeah.
It was, to me, the perfect kind of game that's like, I'm going to sit here with a root beer float, occasionally press a button on this controller, and mostly just have a fun, relaxing time with my friends. I had a very positive experience with it. I absolutely will play more of it, and as I said earlier, I'd buy another one. I'd love to see it get fleshed out a bit, but what's there already, I had a really good time with.
That's great. And that kind of leads me into the wrap-up of our discussion. And you've already kind of shared this a little bit. So just really quickly, what are your overall thoughts on the Animal Crossing franchise?
I think that it's great. You know, again, it's not my thing, but that doesn't really mean I dislike it. I think that it's cool that, you know, they made this IP that, you know, a lot of people feel really passionately about. It appeals to, you know, more demographics than some of Nintendo's other IP. I love, especially now that they're branching out and experimenting with it. You know, I'm always very, very enthusiastic about these more experimental franchises. I put a lot more stock into the experimental franchises than I do some of the tried and true ones that refuse to change or innovate or, you know, do anything new.
Yeah.
So I'm overall very positive on Animal Crossing. In fact, you know, there was an Animal Crossing movie in Japan that was fairly popular and was actually like a fun, pleasant little movie. But, you know, again, I felt similar about that as I did to Amiibo Festival. It maybe wasn't like the most intense anime movie I've ever seen. I certainly wasn't coming away from it like, oh, my life has been changed. But, you know, it was a pleasant little 90 minutes or whatever. Just, you know, a very pleasant little movie.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel about Animal Crossing.
Pleasant.
It's just a pleasant little IP.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said innovating, because I really feel like, I don't want to say it's like subversive, but I feel like Animal Crossing really does a lot to, you know, play with, you know, especially like we said, communication and interaction and just some of the things that, you know, they do with it. Game design wise, I think are really, you know, interesting and fresh. So, you know, I'm a fan of it. I, you know, like I said, I always end up kind of having an initial burst of time spent with it and then kind of it fades off. But every time I spend with it is always pleasant. Connecting to that, what is your best Animal Crossing memory?
I mean, it might just be playing this week.
Really?
I mean,
with Goldie being like, I didn't want to tell anyone, but it's my birthday today.
Yeah, it was cute. It was the first time I cared about these animals rather than them being nuisances in my life.
Like, oh, better go talk to you or you're going to move out.
Yeah, right? It's just, the whole game, it's just like social contracts the game. It's just not for me. Like, I don't like people demanding all of my time, all the time, always. Why would I like it when a video game has fake animal characters doing that?
Oh, well, you better watch out for Animal Forest X Shin Megami Tensei then. Just kidding.
The thing is, honestly, if Shin Megami Tensei, it's like, you know, I've talked about this. What game was that? Was it Sakura Taisen or Tokimeki Memorial? One of the dating sims I played a long time ago, where if you didn't upkeep your relationship status with all of the girls, like, they'd start getting mad at you for not upkeeping them.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that, but the entire game is designed around that, Animal Crossing. It's like the entire game is built around, like, if you don't talk to your animal friends enough, they're going to punish you.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't handle that. That's, talking to animal friends for me is not fun. So taking the game and the setting and the stuff I like about Animal Crossing out of that framework and placing it in, like, board game world, to me, huge upgrade. I had a ton of fun playing Amiibo Festival this weekend, and I absolutely will play it again. So, yeah, that's probably my best Animal Crossing memory.
Delightful. I'd have to say mine is with Wild World. You know, just, you know, that was my first real experience with it, and, you know, just very memorable time. And what hopes and predictions do you have for the future of the series? You know, I'm sure we're going to get another mainline entry within the next few years. So even though not being a fan, what would it take for you to say if they had Animal Crossing U or Animal Crossing NX, what would it take for you to, you know, really enjoy that game experience, do you think?
Well, I mean, look, the reality is I'm going to buy the next Animal Crossing game in the hopes that that's the Animal Crossing game that works for me. And it's almost certainly going to fail. I don't really know that there's anything they could do that would hook me. And I don't know that that's such a bad thing. Not everyone needs to like everything. I, more likely than not, the next Animal Crossing game is going to be the last Animal Crossing game. I mean, the previous Animal Crossing game. But with new features and, you know, the previous features are going to be, you know, even more built up. And but ultimately, for me, it's just sort of an underlying problem that I'm not interested in social simulators, per se. And, you know, I like love simulators or dating sims or whatever. I'm not into them because it simulates having friends. I'm into them because I typically enjoy the story that's being told. For me, Animal Crossing doesn't have that story element.
Okay.
So it's just the social element, and that for me is, it's not interesting. It's like when I talk about Tokimeki Memorial or Sakura Taisen, and I talk about these social systems as being fun. It's because in those games, it feeds into the visual novel element, or it feeds into the strategy RPG element.
Okay.
When it's just the social element distilled, for me, it's not terribly engaging. It does not capture my interest. So, you know, that's for me, you say, what could Animal Crossing do in the future? Add a tactics mode where you're fighting animals, equipping them, giving them new jobs. I mean, I'd be into that, but in the real world, my predictions for the future... Real world, my predictions for the future. I don't see the game changing very much. I don't see Animal Crossing moving away from what it is, because what it is something that works for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I'm just not one of them. If they added a story mode, I'd probably play it. I mean, it would have to be, you know, a pretty good story for me to put up with, you know, needy raccoons needing me to visit their house more often to...
What if it was Goldie?
I mean, the animal's name and identity doesn't really matter. If I'm not getting something out of it, I'm not gonna stick with it.
Okay, that's fair.
But what about you?
You know, my predictions are, I mean, like you said, I don't see anything too radical changing. I do suspect that at least some of the UI elements from Happy Home Designer will make their way into the next one, you know, just with the kind of the quality of life improvements for placing furniture and stuff. So, I mean, I definitely see that. What I'd really like to see, what would kind of help me out with my one issue with the series is one thing I'd like to see is being able to give, like, and you say jobs, I think you meant more like RPG jobs, right?
Yeah, yeah.
See, I would like to give them jobs, be like, okay, Goldie, you're going to be my gardener. When I'm not around, you're going to go around pulling weeds and, you know, I'll give you a such and such bell income for that, you know, which would also kind of solve some of the economy issues, I think, you know, ending up with way too much money. And then that way I won't, if I go away on vacation, I won't have to worry about my town being overgrown. And then another thing that I think with, as we're seeing, you know, more social media integration and, I didn't mention, but, you know, New Leaf allows you to, you know, like post screenshots to Twitter and stuff. So that was really cute. And if you go back in my Twitter timeline, I did that when the game came out. But what I'd really love to see is like some sort of way to, you know, whether it was through an app or something. I don't know how it would actually work, but if you could like send letters to your animals. So then that way, if I'm like, you know, I'm not really feeling like playing, but I want to, you know, make sure that my favorite animals don't move away, I could send them a little letter. You know, and then that way they get the letter in game. So just ways, like you described it as, you know, being really punishing to, you know, to go back and replay it. So ways to, you know, kind of make that less punishing to go back to your town. I would like to see that, but, you know, we'll just have to see.
All right.
And I really quickly want to talk about our social links question of the week. We said this week we discussed Animal Crossings. What experiences have you had in animal-populated villages over the years? And your enzyme said, I've never played an Animal Crossing game, so I've never had any experiences. Looks like I'm not alone. Where are all the Animal Crossing players? And we know it was a holiday weekend, so if you are an Animal Crossing fan and didn't get a chance to respond to our social links question of the week, please feel free to do so at any time. We will read it on future episodes. So
I'm such a shady bitch because part of me is like,
I hope there's no other one, Sly Kicking. You're the only one.
It would be amazing if everyone was just like, I don't really care for that game.
No, we're just going to skip this episode.
Ah!
Imagine if we had a giveaway or something and then nobody listened because it was Animal Crossing. But, you know, that said, I like Animal Crossing. It's cute and charming and, you know, even if it's a fleeting fun, it's still fun. All right. Anything else you'd like to say about Animal Crossing?
Not so much. I just, you know, I hope that we continue to see some experimentation in spinoff games and maybe even another cute movie, because I'd definitely pay to see that again.
Awesome. All right. Well, let's move on to...
Rumor has it. Rumor has it. Rumor has it. Rumor has it.
Our first big rumor here is actually, it's sourced to Destructoid, but we're going to link you to it over on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
via a post at Silicon Era. And this is a rumor saying that the tomahawk job in the Japanese version of Bravely Second has been replaced by a cowboy class for the game's release in the West. Nintendo and Square Enix both have yet to confirm one way or another whether tomahawk will be changed to cowboy, but I have to say, first off, I'm not really sure why, you know, a lot of people are getting up in arms about this. I'm not really sure why. I think that having a tomahawk class that was basically like super appropriative in design and used a crossbow of all things, like, it's just nonsensical. It's like this caricature of Native American people using a crossbow, like a giant metal bird looking crossbow. Like, what? So I think the switching from a crossbow to like a cowboy theme with like a gun, I just think it's better. I think it makes better use of the existent animations. I think it looks better.
Better watch out for that SJW agenda.
Ah, right. I don't know. I guess it's just one of those things where I feel like
censorship.
If you have the option of not offending people, why wouldn't you take that?
Yeah.
And furthermore, this is just more sensical. Having a tomahawk class that doesn't at least use a effing tomahawk is stupid.
Right?
I don't know. I think this changes for the better. Either way, maybe it's not even a real thing. For all we know, this could just be some elaborate troll set up by people who hate the SJWs.
Yep.
Either way, though, this is probably a thing, and it's something I personally applaud. Saggy, any thoughts?
No, you've hit everything, and, you know, as someone who does not have Native American background, I don't feel like it's really my place to speak to it, but I agree with you. You know, I think it's just in terms of the tomahawk class, not even having a tomahawk, like, what?
Yeah, right? And I mean, I'm glad they don't. I kind of find that offensive, actually, as someone who does have that background. But, right. but still, just, like, dude, it was so lazy. It was already so lazy. I think that this is an upgrade, and it's so weird to me that there are people who don't.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on and see what's up.
I said, hey, what's going on?
All right, so I've got some things to talk about this time. I've been playing more Yo-Kai Watch and, you know, having a lot of fun. Starting to reach some parts that are challenging. So, you know, it's definitely not like a easy face roll baby game. You know, like I've talked about before, I really love, you know, the way that Level 5, you know, puts their games together. They're, I feel, one of the best developers out there right now. And I could really see why Yo-Kai Watch is a big thing. It's almost making me want to watch the anime, but, you know, I know that that's for kids. Not for kids, but, you know, for kids. I also, on a whim, decided to resubscribe to World of Warcraft. You know, got the little anniversary gifts, which are nothing major, but, you know, that's cute for their 11th anniversary. And
holy moly.
I know, right? You know, starting to get a little hype for Legion, honestly, which, you know, might not be out until next September, but
the hype cycle begins.
Yeah, you know, starting to hear about some of the class changes are kind of cool, like outlaw rogues with a hidden pistol, and, you know, some of the different changes. I'm trying to work on my warlock. I want to, you know, hopefully play my warlock a little more when the new expansion hits, so, you know, kind of spending some time on him. There was some talk with some of our listeners about, you know, maybe making some little new characters somewhere, so excited for that part. You know, for me, you know, I like playing MMOs by myself to a degree. That's how I spent a lot of the early time with WoW, playing alone and, you know, just questing and doing stuff and, you know, doing pugs and stuff. But for me, the most fun part of an MMO is always obviously playing with friends. So, you know, it'd be really fun. And if you're still playing WoW out there, you know, just follow me on Twitter. So if you're not already, and let me know your battle tag so I can add you to battle tag on Battle.net. And something that you are very happy about, Captain Spike, is that I've started to play Destiny. It was unfortunately... Woo! Right before the holiday weekend, I had a really busy week at work leading up to the, you know, Thanksgiving holiday here in the States. And then, you know, was away with family. And then now I've been out here to wrap up the weekend and, you know, get this episode recorded. So I haven't been able to spend too much time. But as someone who's never been good at first-person shooters, something about it's just really clicking for me, you know. I don't know what it is. Like, something just really works. and I'm playing a Titan class because I had tried at first to make a Warlock and found that they were a little too glass cannon for me. So I got a Titan, you know, gives me a little more survivability, and just really enjoying, you know, I started out playing on my own, and then when I, you know, the next night or whatever, Captain Spike was available after work, so I was like, hey, join my fire team. And I was like, wow, that was so much easier. I've, like, died 3 times on my own doing that. So I'm not, like, you know, the best at it, but I'm actually really enjoying it. And I'm hoping that I might have time tonight before I have to get ready to wrap up the weekend for the work week to play some more. So I can definitely see the appeal, and I'm excited to play more. Captain Spike, what you been playing?
Awesome. Let's see. So I played more Destiny,
of course.
Obviously. I played some Yo-Kai Watch. Both of them, though, it's still just progress, steady as she goes. Destiny, actually, a little less so. You know, I'll definitely hit that endgame grind on my 2 main characters. So, just, you know, waiting for Sidekick to get back to it so that I can do a little more playtime on my leveling character right now.
Yep.
I also resubbed to WoW. Have not put a lot of time into it yet. Probably only play for a month, but, you know, we'll see how that goes. It's been nice to be back among my characters and seeing some of the new raid content via LFR. So, you know, it's a thing.
It's a comfort food.
It is. WoW is like gaming comfort food. Definitely
just heat it up in the microwave and
got back into Smash this weekend. Probably played a good 6 or 7 hours of Smash this weekend, actually.
Yeah, we did.
Obviously played Amiibo Festival. That was really cool.
Yep.
But, you know, just very much, you know, sort of a maintenance week as far as just keeping up on all the games I play and seeing how it goes. So nothing new and exciting, I think. Slaggy, I... oh, you know, actually, I take that back because there is one. I did play a good chunk of time on Assassin's Creed Syndicate, as I mentioned at the beginning of this show. And that has been a tremendous... Oh, man, now I'm thinking back to Target's buy two, get one free sale. I also picked up Guitar Hero Live, which, you know, despite my previously stated reservations, I'm actually having a really great time with. I really do think that the GHTV functionality, where you're streaming content rather than, like, buying DLC, actually does kind of feel, like, really fun and innovative, which you don't see a lot of in that
rhythm game space.
And you're
like, oh, what will be on the TV next?
And it actually does feel a little bit like the future. Like, it really does feel like that's the way the genre should be growing. Assassin's Creed Syndicate, like I said, having a really great time with it. I popped in Fallout and actually, funny enough, did not play it. It installed. I was going to let my roommate play it before I played it. He ended up getting it on PC. And so I was like, oh, cool. Well, I'll play it. And then I just haven't made time for it. Like, I actually watched its title screen for like 20 minutes once. And then I was like, actually, on second thought, I'll just go back to Assassin's Creed. And that's really says a lot about how much I'm enjoying Assassin's Creed, I think.
Wow.
Yeah. So
that's good news.
I think it's probably the best the series has been since original Assassin's Creed 2. And I can't possibly give an Assassin's Creed game better.
That's a good benchmark for the series.
Well, exactly. I couldn't possibly give an Assassin's Creed game better feedback than that. So definitely super into it. And I'll probably have more to say about it next week.
Excellent. All right, then.
And, you know, I hate to do this to you, Slaggy, but do we have any social links?
We do, actually. Yeah. So
I'm going to, despite the fact that you're hosting Animal Crossing Bui, I can't do social links like you can.
Well, no problem. First up, before we read our tweets, I wanted to give a shout out to Twitter user J Masterclaw. I apologize. For some reason, direct message notifications have not been showing up. I don't know if it's the app I'm using or whatever, but I apologize for just seeing this now. And this was in response to our episode about the world of Mario, you know, the different kind of cultural appearances and appeal and all of that of Mario. And so J Master Claw had pointed out that the Koopalings, I'd made a mention on that episode about them having different names than in Super Mario Bros. 3, and J Master Claw had pointed out that the cartoon series went into production before the game was being finished localized over here, and Nintendo of America hadn't, you know, given them a name, so...
Thank you for the feedback.
Yeah.
We like when people write in and point stuff out to us.
Indeed. So, the next couple of tweets I want to read, that was from, of course, I said a Twitter direct message, and I apologize for anyone who's tried to, like, direct message us or whatever and not gotten feedback. And also, before I read the tweets, I noticed that I thought I had followed a lot of people back on the Game Booey Twitter, but there were a lot of people who follow us who had not followed back, so I sincerely apologize about that. It was, you know, not my intention. I'd like to pick up with a Twitter thread that had started in our last episode with your enzyme saying regretting about trading in the SNES for a PS1. So Dan Diaz continued that since that episode, saying, "Don't feel too bad. I sold mine to buy the Saturn." And then your enzyme said, "That would have been such a disappointment, even though the Saturn did have some great games." Your enzyme also picking up about Twilight Princess. We had talked about, you know, the HD remaster coming. Saying to you, you mentioned how the Twilight Princess dungeons were, how good the Twilight Princess dungeons were at the end. Agreed, but they were also too few, IMO. The rushed end of TP was what I hated about that game. Here's hoping the HD release will have some extension. You know, even if it's just like a Master Quest mode or something, it'd be nice to see that. I agree. Also saying, thanks Slagkick for forcing Spike to explain Hanafuda cards. Not all of us knew what they were, you butt. You were the butt in this case.
Yeah, even when I was editing that, I actually almost cut it out because I realized it sounded really presumptive, and I didn't mean to do that. I just, to me, I've known about that for so long that I really lost perspective on the fact that it's not super common knowledge. So, sorry, guys.
And also wanted to thank Dan Diaz for a shout-out to our show. He was telling his friend Mad Gamer Doctor over on Twitter about us because we had talked about Dan Diaz last time saying the voiceover that they did on their Talk Boy. And so he was saying, over on GameBooey.org, I was mentioning that to them. And then so Mad Gamer Doctor's like, what is this podcast? And so Dan Diaz said, it's a podcast a couple of friends do. If you got space, I recommend it, not only because they're friends.
Like, thank you for the kind words.
And then Dan Diaz mentioned, I'm pretty sure we did the opera scene too, ha ha ha. And Mad Gamer Doctor said, I'll check it out. So, Mad Gamer Doctor, if you're listening, thank you for tuning in.
Welcome aboard, as we say.
We got a Two-A-Penny on Twitter saying thanks for the recent follow. So, we love following you guys back. And apologies to anyone for whom that was delayed. With that, I hate to say it, but we need to wrap up and send this episode off.
Yeah. Please. This episode is longer than my hate boner for Animal Crossing at this point.
Captain Spike.
You want to do the solicitations?
Sure. We love your feedback. We love your iTunes subscriptions, ratings, and reviews. We love Stitcher Radio, so if you're tuning in there, hello, hello, hello. We like your Facebook likes. We effing love Twitter.
Effing love Twitter.
And, all of our social links are available on GameBooey.org.
GameBooey.org.
If you ever want to email us, you can do that at MailBooey@GameBooey.org.
MailBooey@GameBooey.org.
And, go over to GameBooey.org to check all those social links out. And we wouldn't be here without our friends in the podcasting scene and, who support us and keep us going, along with all you listeners out there. So, Captain Spike, give us some shout-outs, some realness.
As ever and always, my first shout out goes to VG Realness, serving up a weekly dose of gaming chit chat among friends, as well as Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice and from whom I steal ever so many of my cues. You should also check out the Nintendo Fun Club, your place for platformers, positivity, and pop punk, as well as Nintendo Love Fest, which does exactly what it says on the tin. They have a lovely sister show in the form of X Nation, an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants. Another show you should check out, which is Reading is Fundamental. This is Slagkick's show. It is a sister show to what you're listening to right now, focused on RuPaul's Drag Race and co-starring myself, Rob Roberts from Orange Lounge Radio, and Delvin from VG Realness. You should also check out the Starboard Power Coupling Podcast, a Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail, and last but never ever least, Tables, Ladders, and Podcast, a professional wrestling podcast for the common man. Slaggy, why don't you take us to a Hunty Bunch Game Bar?
So I would like to shout out to our Hunty Bunch. That includes Game Bar, the gay video game Prairie Home Companion, and a part of our Hunty Bunch. Koopa Club, an award-winning podcast about Nintendo and gaming with an LGBT twist, and Joystick Jockeys, two LGBTQ gamers who love games and love talking about them, and La Polanca Podcast Pori para gay gamers Latino Americanos in Espanol. We love supporting our fellow queer gaming podcasters. Of course, we have VG Realness up in there as well, part of our Hunty Bunch. I'd like to also direct you to the VogNetwork.com website. That's the Voice of Geeks Network, where you can get all sorts of geeky content, including Orange Lounge Radio, Starboard Power Coupling Podcast, and Girls Gone Wild, where you can get a female perspective on the world's most popular MMO. Last but not least, I'd like to shout out to a little show called Anime Buoy, your protocol for anime recommendations, news bits, and discussions that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. We'll be getting you with an Anime Buoy or War II in the next week or so. As everyone always, our theme music was done by Zelda Reorchestrated, a late great project that aimed to reorchestrate beautiful Zelda music into gorgeous symphonic sound. They closed their doors a while back, but we'll forever be pouring out a 40 into the great fairy fountain for them. Captain Spike, anything you'd like to say to our lovely, beautiful listeners out there before we send the ship off?
You know, keep gaming and
hey,
that's
my
thinking.
Job today.
Bitch! Keep gaming and keep thinking. Slaggy?
Thank you all of you in Radioland for tuning in to us out there. We'll be back at you soon, wrapping up our 1990s. But until then, keep gaming, keep thinking, and...
I'm sorry, are we playing Rayman right now?
No, that's what they sound like.
Mics are hot.
Hot mics, hot mics. Magic mic.
You ready?
Magic mic. Magic mic, magic mic.
Go again.
Magic mic.
Go again.
Magic mic.
And again.
Magic mic, magic mic.
All right, you should be good.
Hot magic mic. Ready?
Yep.
All right. You got that off kind of quick. Strania the Stella Machina was, you know, originally a 360 title a couple years ago, so good to see that coming to Steam. You know, this is the most recent mainline series game. Ugh, sorry.
Rumor has it.